Mark Titus spent his college basketball career collecting splinters in his red shorts on the bench. He was a walk-on, good enough to win a spot on the roster of Ohio State University's vaunted Big Ten basketball team from 2006 to 2010, and he set the record for most individual career wins in school history while scoring just 9 points, 9 points only, 4 years. Mark Titus founded a blog called Club Trillion, because that's what all the zeros that follow your name look like when you play 1 minute a game but get no points or assists or much besides another cup of Gatorade. His new memoir, Don't Put Me in, Coach, My Incredible Journey from the End of the Bench to the End of the Bench. Mark Titus joins us from the studios of WOSU in Columbus. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And let's understand this. You weren't on the Ohio State team 4 years because you were so good, but because the really good players kept getting drafted by the pros.
Yeah, something like that. I was actually pretty good childhood friends with the number one recruit in the country, Greg Oden, and he committed to Ohio State, and I came to Ohio State with him, and there's no doubt in my mind that it was because of Greg.
Well, you weren't just his friend. You were a very good high school basketball player.
Yeah, I was above average, yeah, but high school was probably my ceiling. I just made the decision to come to Ohio State and not play basketball, actually, and somehow, yeah, I got on the team.
How did you talk yourself out of a Harvard scholarship?
They talked it out for me. I actually kind of fell through. I was recruited pretty heavily by Harvard, and they'd come to watch.
A couple of coaches were set up to come to a game.
Yeah, they had watched me play like 10 times. It was my understanding that they were more or less coming to just like support me rather than recruit. Earlier in the week, me and my high school coach got into a little bit of a fight, and I was suspended for the first half of the game that the Harvard coaches were at. I came back out in the second half, and they were gone, and I never heard from them again. So it's not really smart to put all your eggs in a Harvard basket, but that's kind of what I did.
Would you have been on the same team as Jeremy Lin?
I think we actually would have been in the same freshman class. So I like to tweak the story now that he's been successful, that my spot went to him.
Well, you got to the Final Four as a freshman there at Ohio State, and that was a close game you lost to Florida for the national championship.
Yeah.
Even though in your own account you weren't, shall we say, central to that or any other game. Was that tough?
It was hard for me because my friends, Greg Oden and Mike Conley, who was our point guard that year, us three actually had played AAU basketball together since we were in like junior high. They were our two best players, and they were like the reason we even made it to the national championship game. So I kind of knew that was my last game I'd ever play with them unless I somehow miraculously made it to the NBA and we all got on the same team. So for me, it was unfortunate that our time together had to end on a sour note. But looking back, though, that Florida team that we lost to was one of the best teams in like the past 25 years.
When we fans watch at home, obviously March Madness set to begin, what should we look for in a big college basketball game?
I think the thing that makes college basketball in particular stand out from pros, I mean, you'll hear basketball fans say it all the time, but I mean, it's like the passion of the players, because with college, especially in the tournament, you get the guys that are seniors, and they know, especially at like the smaller schools, they know that this is their last chance to play basketball, and so they like pull up the miracle upset against the team full of NBA guys. You know, that happens seemingly every year, so that's what makes college basketball great to me, I think.
You did get, if I might refer to it as your 15 minutes of fame as a senior at OSU. Tell us about that last game, if you could.
Yeah, I wrote about it on my blog, and there were a lot of fans that like knew that this was my last game because I was having surgery the next day. So while some of our other seniors would get a play at the Big Ten tournament and the NCAA tournament, this was the last time I'd ever wear an Ohio State jersey. So I come out, and there are like 3,000 students wearing T-shirts of my blog's logo on them. They introduced me, and I was just kind of overcome with emotion. I started crying, and it's still pretty embarrassing to talk about now, and I still get a lot of flack from it from my teammates. And we won big enough to where I got to get in, and I was out on the court as the horn sounded, and we won the Big Ten. I mean, I don't think I could have scripted it any better how it ended up working out for me.
Mark Titus, his new book, a memoir of his 4 years on the bench and in the hearts of Ohio State, is called Don't Put Me in, Coach, My Incredible Journey from the End of the Bench to the End of the Bench. Mr. Titus also writes for Grantland.com, the sports blog. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Chai Guo-cheung uses gunpowder to create two kinds of art. Now, first, there's a performance event when he puts the gunpowder on huge canvases, then sets it off, and then the canvases marked by the explosion can be hung up on a wall, say at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles, also known as the MoCA, where reporter Alex Schmidt went to see him.
anticipation is a big part of Chai Guoqiang's performances. There's a feeling of wired expectation in the high-ceilinged room as he takes hours to prepare his canvas. 25 volunteer assistants, plus an audience, watch him expectantly. The enormous panels are laid out on the floor, and black gunpowder is sprinkled over the whole thing. Chai dances over it in slippers. He drops bits of cardboard over here, makes swirling movements with his arms over there. Suddenly, Chai sits down on a chair. A coordinator speaks through a microphone, and the audience sits up.
Please put on your gloves and goggles and booties and masks, please.
The volunteers pick up a giant cardboard stencil and slowly lay it over the canvases. Finally, Chai announces through his interpreter that he's ready. The audience sits up again as Chai steps onto the canvas.
All the cameras ready?
He lights a fuse. The explosion is very bright, very, very loud, and lasts only a few seconds. Smoke fills the room, and then it's chaos as the assistants tamp out flames with bundles of cloth and remove the ragged stencil. They reveal the enduring part of the artwork, a sort of cosmic skyscape that got burned into the canvas during the explosion. Windy shapes blow across it in dark browns and grays.
He described it as a volcano, but it kind of looks more like a tornado in the middle, and the branches on the side.
Audience member Geraldine Chung looks on as assistants lean the huge panels against a wall.
It's really amazing. And oh, we've got a piece with color now. I don't know how he can kind of anticipate the way that things are going to come out.
Actually, Chai says he can't anticipate the way things are going to come out. There's always a prevalent sense of anxiety and uncontrollability in the work, he says, and that's a lot like life. Chai was still in a state of hazy elation after the explosion. He'll be doing another one in April to open his MoCA exhibit. For NPR News, I'm Alex Schmidt.
This is NPR News. I hope it's not ungentlemanly to note that Junie Hwang is 40 years old. Her birth date appears in the Internet Movie Database, or IMDb, and the fact that she's played a headless woman in Domain of the Damned and Miss Fix-It in Voodoo Dolly. She doesn't sound like a woman to cross. Junie Hwang is going to court against IMDb, which is owned by Amazon, because they reveal her age in her entry. She believes that could cost her work. Male actors over 40, Harrison Ford, Daniel Craig, Morgan Freeman, Christopher Plummer, play cowboys, spies, and heroes, whereas filmmakers seem to pass all roles for women over 40 between Dame Helen Mirren, Meryl Streep, and Dame Judi Dench. Betty White gets every role over 80. But Junie Hwang's case could have implications beyond allegations of age prejudice. Junie Hwang is a stage name. The actress known as Junie Hwang was born Hoon Hwang, and there are about 600 people by that name in the United States. Now, how would IMDb know that Junie Hwang, the actress who's played in a film called Saturday Night Cleaver, is Hoon Hwang, who was born July 16, 1971, in Saigon? Did Amazon IMDb, as the lawsuit suggests, mine their database of credit card information, bank history, and perhaps public records, not to expose a criminal conspiracy or a terrorist plot, but merely to come up with the birth date of an actress? An Amazon spokesman says it's their policy to refuse comment on all pending lawsuits. Still, what's so vital about an actor's birth date? Actors and actresses, after all, are professional deluders. They dye their hair and wear false teeth for roles. Russell Crowe from New Zealand plays American cowpokes, and Meryl Streep from New Jersey plays the Prime Minister of Britain, a Danish writer, a Polish Holocaust survivor, and more, and takes home gold statues for it. Jonathan Turley at the George Washington Law School told us Junie Hwang's case raises a legitimate complaint that is long overdue. The assumption of industry is that any information accessed by a third party has no expectation of privacy. That is not the assumption, he says, most citizens have. So when we order a book or buy socks on the Internet, do we know we may undo a latch on a lid that lets companies drill down for personal information. Not just age, but medications we take, magazines we may read, or that we once ordered Lolita or Das Kapital. Professor Turley says Junie Huang's case could help establish curbs and codes to protect privacy. Junie Huang played a headless woman, but she might wind up being a real figure in legal history. That's Rockwell, and you're listening to NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The U.S. job market continues to improve. The Labor Department says employers added 227,000 workers to their payrolls last month. That's a solid, if not spectacular, performance and continues a trend that suggests a genuine recovery, not a blip. The unemployment rate held steady at 8.3%, even as nearly 500,000 people joined the workforce. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The American job market is still a long way from healthy, but its pulse feels a lot stronger now than it did 6 months ago. That's a boon for President Obama as he tries to hold on to his own job in November.
Day by day, we're creating new jobs, but we can't stop there. Not until everybody who's out there pounding the pavement, sending out their resumes, has a chance to land one of those jobs.
Employers have added more than 200,000 jobs in each of the last 3 months. Over the last 6 months, private employers have added 1.3 million jobs. That's the strongest six-month period of job growth in almost 6 years. Alan Krueger, who chairs the President's Council of Economic Advisers, says the cumulative picture is an economy on the mend.
We are digging our way out of the deep hole that the president inherited when he took office.
Employers are putting out help wanted signs in many different industries. Bars and restaurants added 41,000 jobs in February. There were 61,000 more jobs in healthcare and social work and 82,000 in business and professional services. About half of those were in temporary firms. Joni Ruge of the Randstad temporary firm says business began picking up late last year.
I can tell you that some of the hottest jobs right now are in information technology. We are also seeing a very strong demand in engineering, which is a good sign, as well as accounting and finance. That continues to pick up.
Mr. Obama has been highlighting manufacturing jobs. And yesterday, he visited a Rolls-Royce jet engine parts factory in Virginia. U.S. factories added 31,000 jobs in February and more than 400,000 over the last 2 years.
So the economy is getting strong. And when I come to places like this and I see the work that's being done, it gives me confidence there are better days ahead.
The Rolls-Royce Crosspoint plant is part of a joint effort to promote advanced manufacturing, along with universities, community colleges, and the government. Mr. Obama wants to duplicate that model elsewhere. He proposed a $1 billion effort to develop manufacturing institutes around the country.
I don't want it just here at Crosspoint. I want it everywhere. To do that, we need Congress to act.
While House lawmakers okayed a modest jobs bill this past week, Congress has been slow to embrace many of the president's economic proposals. Meanwhile, Republican presidential hopefuls have tried to tag Mr. Obama as an economic failure. That task is made more difficult by the improving jobs numbers. Mitt Romney didn't specifically address the new employment report on the campaign trail yesterday, but he argues the slow pace of recovery is nothing to brag about.
First of all, talk to the 24 million Americans that are out of work or underemployed in this country.
To be sure, 8.3% unemployment is still painfully high and a potential liability for Mr. Obama. While the recent trend line is good and the jobless rate is now as low as it's been since his first full month in office, Mr. Obama says that's not good enough.
I did not run for this office just to get back to where we were. I ran for this office to get us to where we need to be.
Mr. Obama says his goal is to restore middle-class security, adding some challenges take longer than one term to achieve. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.